You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme... The introduction of France's labour reforms has sparked nationwide protests and now a massive run on petrol. Will President Hollande pay a high price? And we'll discuss the latest Brazilian scandal that's threatening to engulf the country's new administration. Also ahead... Why is India joining the race to develop a reusable spacecraft? And what's the best country to live in after you've finished your degree and exhausted the bank of mum and dad? That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Geoffrey Kaufman, a veteran network television news and war correspondent, and Tim Marshall, who's the editor of the whatandthewhy.com and a former diplomatic editor at Sky News. Welcome both back to the programme. Good to have you with us. Let's start with some of this. Demonstrations and strikes have resulted in one in five of France's petrol stations running out of fuel. Unions have blockaded French oil refineries and depots in recent days to protest against President François Hollande's controversial labour reforms. Could this bring him down? Tim, what's the lesson here? Is it don't try and reform the French labour laws front and centre?
No, it's plus ça change. It is the French are revolting. This is a frequent occurrence. You just have to go through the motions and at the end of it. I mean, France has always had much stronger unions than, for example, the United Kingdom, and they have always been more violent. It is part of the process to take to the streets. It invariably descends into violence. It's the CGT. The Confédération Générale du Travail, which is, I think, the strongest union in France. It's actually the second biggest, but it's the strongest union. And these laws, what they're calling anti-union laws, have been railroaded, rammed through government, and they're now paying the price. And, of course, timing is everything. And although I do think this is normal... and it happens all the time, periodically. What I'm particularly concerned about is that the European Football Championships kick off in about 3 weeks' time.
Well, or do they? We'll come on to that in a minute. But, Geoffrey, that prompts me to ask you, I mean, who's in charge in France? Is it the CGT? Is it President Hollande? It doesn't seem like it.
I think the more pressing question that actually has been a pressing question for years is where is France going? And I think that the marginalization of the French economy in Europe and in the Western world is something that we've watched happen in kind of slow motion over the last couple of decades. As globalization, as competitiveness have taken hold here in the UK, of course, in North America, but in Germany and all around France. France is kind of stuck in those halcyon days of you know, long lunches and afternoon wine, 35-hour week.
Precisely, sounds terrible, doesn't it?
Well, it's terrible if you're in a company. It's terrible if you want to invest. It's terrible if your company grows beyond a certain size and specific labor laws forbidding a dismissal kick in. And the French government is trying to address some of this. The IMF is saying this is essential for competitiveness. French unemployment hovers around 10%. The country needs a structural change. The unions do not want it, and that's fundamentally what we're watching now. A lot of economists believe that France is a slow motion, a train wreck in slow motion, and that if it doesn't address these structural problems, it cannot sustain the fiction of prosperity.
So, Tim, should we be looking at France then in this sort of slow motion train wreck? Is it a country in crisis? Obviously, there's been much turbulence since, understandably, the attacks last year and the ongoing state of emergency, which is drawing supposedly to a close. But does the crisis run deeper than just that?
No, well, I don't think it is in crisis, but I do agree with most of the things that Jeffrey said. This is a long-term problem. It is a structural problem in France. They are still trying to live the good life, but without the money to pay for it. The capitalist world in red or blue, in tooth and claw, has overtaken it. But they're still fighting the battles that many other countries, especially Britain, to a lesser extent, Scandinavia and Germany, has already fought. Now, look, some of the stuff, I understand. They are making it easier to fire people. Why is a socialist government bringing in that? Because the economy is in such a desperate situation that they're hoping that if they make it easier to fire people, the companies will actually take on a lot of people now, knowing that they can shed them later on if there's a downturn.
Is that how socialism works today?
It is not in any way, shape or form how socialism works, but Mr. Hollande dumped socialism, just like Mr. Mitterrand did before him in the 80s, within a few weeks of coming to power. This is a longer term thing, but that they are still fighting the battles that other people have fought. And you can take a different view. You can say, well, actually, I suppose the unions, and I think they're actually doing the right thing in trying to protect workers' rights. They nearly always go about it through violence. As I said, I am looking, very selfishly to the championships. Prime Minister Valls has taken a very hard line and said, we are not going to back down on this. The CGT say they're not going to back down. There are more strikes for the railways and the metro system for June the 2nd. And that's just a week to go before the football. So it's the slow and the furious.
Jeffrey, let me ask you, though, about this: the fact that it always seems to boil out onto the streets. There seems to be a sense of unrest in France. Whether you look back to, the spirit of 68 and how that endures, something simmering away. And presumably it's not union activists, or certainly not exclusively, who then take to the streets in the banlieue, who are setting fire to police cars. Why is there such a simmering... this readiness to take the streets, to argue with the state in this way?
I think there are two ways to look at this, depending on your politics and your perspective. And on one hand, this is an engaged electorate that feels it should have a sense of participation in these massive decisions, and that is constructive democracy. On the other hand, it is an entitled electorate that feels that it doesn't have to make the sacrifices and the modernization, adapt the modernization that so many other economies have experienced. This country with a sledgehammer under Margaret Thatcher, and the U.S. under various presidents of its own. It really is. It's an ideal. The answer to that is ideological, and I think that somewhere in the middle probably lies some sort of mushy truth. But you do have a militant stream of labor leadership in France that often colors and taints intelligent, reasonable discourse. Mm. But at the same time, you have labor protecting the rights of workers and trying to balance it. I think the problem is, as I said earlier, the problem is that this is a global world, and France is part of the European Union. And if you are going to open a widget factory in Europe, you are not going to go to France to do it. Yeah. That is the bottom line.
There's already been a one of the major industrialists in Total, the oil, who has said our backers are thinking about not investing in here. You said 68. Sorry to interrupt you, Jeffrey. You said 68. I'd take you all the way back to 1848. Then I'd go forward to the Paris Commune, 1870. The French the 1930s, the 50s, there is this massive division in French society between right and left, much more pronounced than it is in, for example, my own country. The CGT only broke from the Parti Communiste about 10 years ago, I think. And the other side of the coin, of course, is the Front National. So the point I'm making is that politics in France goes more quickly to the left and to the right than it does in many other modern democracies.
And that strikes me as interesting. Does that mean that then maybe the mainstream abandons the centre ground altogether?
Much more quickly.
Yes. But could this be an enduring problem in France then?
Well, it has been. It's been an enduring problem since, before the Fifth Republic, and I think we are going to see more of it. And I think we are going to see the rise of the Front National. Well, we're seeing it, and they've got their election next year at the moment, especially with Mr. Hollande is now presiding again over violence on the streets. Monsieur Hollande may not even make it past the first round, and the National Front probably will make it past
the first round. He's in this realm where his poll ratings are... they're record-breakingly low. I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
Listen, he can take great comfort that he's not governing Brazil.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. I want to talk more about football, though, because I know Tim's keen to. It's interesting that we're talking about additional deployments of troops, additional deployments of police. Is that the right way to go about this? And it's not just the, it's not just the football. If we talk about cycling, you've got the Tour de France, the world's biggest sporting event by certain measures.
The Tour de France.
And why do you regard it as being an unpoliceable event? So how do they tackle the potential risks?
With great difficulty. The Tour de France and the European Championships actually overlap by about a week. I mean, the championships are 3 weeks long, but the first week of them, there's two sporting events. They are stretched to the max, which is why they're deploying every person they can get
hold of. Is that a good idea, Tim, do you think?
Well, I think it is, because I honestly think the risk is so great. Saturday, I think over the weekend, Paris Saint-Germain played. Flares got into the stadium. Firecrackers got into the stadium. Incendiary devices got into the stadium and were all let off, despite three cordons to get in, supposedly searching people. Now, these were just ordinary football fans with flares. Now, if that's how good your security is, I think you need to beef it up over the next 3 weeks.
And Jeffrey, just a word from you on that. High-profile events, we know that the Paris attackers targeted indeed a football match that the national team were playing at the Stade de France during those incidents. Should we be concerned? Is additional deployments of police, is that a good idea though, or does it risk being seen as an antagonistic gesture by people on the left rather than by these interests?
Sadly, these kind of terrorist acts now have made it put governments in an impossible position, because you can't ignore it, and yet you don't want to create a culture of paralysis. And so they have to do it, and there is a vulnerability. And I think what we've seen is that France is very much with a restive Muslim population that's never been properly entreated to join the mainstream of French society is really a ticking time bomb, as is Belgium. I mean, these countries have really done an abysmal job of inclusiveness, much, much worse than here in the UK, than in Canada, in the US, and even in Germany. And sadly, they're paying a price for it. This disenfranchisement leaves them vulnerable. So, they have to be vigilant. It's just a sad reality of 2016.
Just on that point about inclusiveness, how do you address that? Because that's not something that you can't get a president in on an inclusiveness ticket at the moment. It seems unlikely. And the changes you're talking about are beyond just structural economic changes. They're societal. They're about urbanism. Yeah,
they're values changes.
They're very profound.
Yeah, they are.
What are the drivers for that in France then?
I come from Canada, where it's very interesting to see the kind of what happens when what they call new Canadians arrive. And it was interesting. The Germans went and studied the schools in Canada to look at this. But they, the children are welcomed from many countries. The parents go through programs, and there are certain that people are taught some of the assumptions. Don't throw your trash on the ground. That kind of thing, which can lead to an antagonism and incite kind of nasty comments, and little values things and bigger things. And it requires, though, a complete sort of realignment of French values. And I think it's just hard to imagine, given the economic despair that the country is in, that the kind of money required to do this is going to be forthcoming.
Well, talking of economic despond, and you mentioned it already a moment ago.
I gave you a great opportunity to segue to Brazil, but you had to go to the football thing.
But you keep saying
That's
things
football,
that are interesting.
Brazil, football.
But Brazil, football, political football now, yes.
Actually, this is great.
We
should have you back more often, Jeffrey.
There you go.
The scandals.
Do you want to switch chairs? Just excuse me while the audience...
We could do. Don't bring down the fourth wall. The scandals involving Brazilian politics couldn't get any worse. Along came Romero Jucá, the close ally of the country's acting president, has now stepped aside after being caught on tape allegedly conspiring to obstruct Brazil's largest ever corruption investigation. Now, Tim, I almost lose my bearings with who's been accused of corruption, who's been convicted of corruption, who's suspended
most
for corruption. Now you've got people plotting in a corrupt way to stop a corruption investigation. It seems to be completely circular. It seems to be completely self-destructive. How bad has it got in Brazil?
That was my first thought about the story. Is there anybody that isn't accused of something in political life in Brazil? I mean, that is the wider meaning of the story, and the meaning for Brazil as it tries to become this modern Latin American country that left behind the dark days, and it clearly hasn't. Right, here's the story so far. We'll move on from the impeachment of the president. The acting president has got a planning minister. The planning minister had a conversation in March which was recorded, and That in itself is a story. Who the hell recorded his private conversation?
Yeah, we'll talk about this
with another politician.
Actually, it was the head of one of the oil firms.
Yeah. So, yeah. And both of them say, well, we weren't recording it. So who was? Anyway, this was in March. And I'm glad you said alleged there, Tom, because it is alleged. He said, we have to change the government to be able to stop the bleeding. That is, and the army is with us. That has been taken to mean he meant we have to change the government and get rid of Dilma Rousseff, the president, and the army won't stand in our way in order to stop this hemorrhaging. Da, da, da. He's saying, no, I was talking about the economy. Therefore, the government might need changing because, you know, the economy is in a bad position. And so there's his plausible deniability. The problem is the transcripts are an hour long, and at no point in the hour does he say the word economy. So he's now stood down temporarily. There's another investigation, and he joins the massed ranks of Brazilian politicians from all sectors who are now under investigation for corruption.
And the problem is, Yuka is a very accomplished economist who really the new prime minister was looking to help him write a budget to get Brazil, at least, if not back on track, to moving forward. And so this is a massive setback, because this is one of the most trusted members of this all-white conservative cabinet that has impeached...
All male, all white,
yes. In a country that is nothing, that it has a very small white population.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you have to go back to Dilma Rousseff and why they impeached her. And you know, amidst all the allegations of corruption, she's actually not accused of stealing anything. No. She's accused of fixing the books to balance the budget.
To get elected,
right. Yeah.
And so, heaven forbid a politician.
Right, exactly. So in terms of corruption, you know, in the pantheon of Brazilian corruption, it's hard to really be outraged. I mean, what she did was political finagling, and yes, there is a gamesmanship that's gone on, and yes, it's almost certainly gone on many times in Brazil. But now, you know, as you know, they're facing this. You know, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't. Well, now, careful. You know, now Dilma's looking awfully good now.
Well, they are playing with fire as well now, Tom, because people have invoked, oh, the army's not going to stand in the way.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you.
This is obviously the next thing that's coming now.
A lot of Dilma's allies have said, look, this was a coup by proxy.
Soft coup.
That was rejected. But if you have a minister, a high-profile individual, talking about having friendly chats with the military, you know, that means something very, very
Indeed.
Specific in a country
especially
like
in Latin America. And I, up to this point, was an open mind, you know, okay, she's bound to say it's a coup against me in order to save her skin. On the other hand, maybe it wasn't. You know, I don't know. I still don't know. But the guy that the planning minister, who's now stood down temporarily, was talking to, in response to the, being told we've got to change the government, said the easiest solution would be to put in Michel, as in Michel Temer, who's now the president. Now, maybe that's cause and effect. Maybe it's simply, oh, gosh, look, that's how it turned out, but nobody actually planned it. But it looks terrible. And the Workers' Party are on the streets. That's Dilma's Rousseff's party. They are on the streets. They are angry. The situation is getting worse. Brazil, I think, is above the sort of politics of the 60s, 70s and 80s of Latin America. And let's make absolutely sure it is. But I don't like to see it being tested in this way.
Listen, I spent 10 years covering Latin America for ABC News. And Brazil is a world unto itself in Latin America. Of course, it's isolated by language because as by far the largest country in the region at 204 million or so, and with this linguistic wall of Portuguese around it, it's always had in the 20th century an isolationist perspective with its relationship to the rest of Latin America. But it does have, and I was actually there just a couple of months ago, it does have its own unique version of dysfunction. I mean, it really is extraordinary how inefficient it is. It's a country that's so easy to love, and in the next breath, so easy to be exasperated by. I mean, just the smallest things require the most ridiculous amount of inefficiency. And you do encounter this, let's be clear, in other countries in Latin America. Argentina has its own quirks. But the problem is that you know, Argentina is, what, 44 million. Brazil is more than four times that. It is, what, the seventh largest country or economy in the world. It is a massive and important player that is just cannot stand up on its own two feet. Lula, who preceded Rousseff, is actually looking really good when you think about it, because he brought a degree of stability. Mm-hmm. I think that what's so sad about this, because it is a wonderful country mired in poverty, rich in resources, rich in opportunity, but just so terribly pathologically corrupt, is that now the world's focus is going to hone in on Rio as the Olympics approach. Mm. And there are so many uncertainties already. Some of the transit projects may not be finished. The highways weren't really upgraded. You know, if you remember, as I do, the debacle of the Atlanta Olympics in, what was it, 96, mm. you know, this could be much worse and a much bigger stain to the pride of a nation that has so much to be proud for. And it's really sad. Rousseff will not be there to open the games. This pretender to the throne, Temer, is going to do it, at least as of this week.
Well, this is the thing. It changes so fast. Just on this, and it strikes me as interesting, we talked about the seemingly intractable structural problems that France is facing. What's the solution here? Because you've got not even really a generation, but an entire political system that's so racked by corruption or claims of corruption. You've got a populace who, if they haven't lost faith altogether, are losing it very rapidly with the entire political class, if not system. How do you put that right? Because that's not even something you can change in a generation.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, because one of the sort of the things that you learn when you cover developing countries and you watch what they call emerging democracies try to get on their feet is that it requires, there are a couple of things that are essential ingredients for a country to get out of that kind of mess. It's a generational thing, but it requires a strong police force that is held accountable. In order to do that, you have to have a justice system that's independent, and then it goes from there. It's really interesting, but those are the two foundations, I think, of building a stable democracy. If you look at Colombia, which was a very unstable country for so long, you know, when the president, when Uribe tried to go for a third term, the Supreme Court that he appointed said, no, you're violating the Constitution. That's what you call a strong institution when that kind of action happens. And that's why Colombia is an economic tiger compared to most of its neighbors in Latin America, because it's starting to build the infrastructure, the institutions of a stable civil society.
Well, let's move on and let's talk after.
Sorry for the political science lecture, but it's quite interesting.
Corruption is so corrosive.
Well, let's talk about another BRIC country. You mentioned Brazil. Let's talk about India. And it's interesting that India's launched an unmanned model space shuttle yesterday at who knows what cost, but maybe signalling to the world that it's joining the race to develop.
74 million, I think.
There you go. See, this is why we keep you around, Tim. Mm-hmm. A reusable spacecraft. But why are they doing it? Well, Tim, you seem to know quite a great deal. Is this a power play?
He knows one fact so far.
Is it a vanity project, or is there something functional here?
Yes, is space travel at all a vanity project? Discuss. I mean, it depends. You know, if you want to heat hospitals or you want to go to the moon, India wants to do both, and as one of the major countries in the world, intends to do both. And this is where the international politics comes into it. China is way ahead of it. Mm. Those two see themselves as the two big rivals, and so India's not going to get left behind. It looks very much like Thunderbird 2 for older listeners. It's that sort of fat one that this thing comes out of the bottom of it and flies off. It's a very, very similar project, but slightly more expensive. What it is that cutting-edge space travel technology has gone towards reusable, because apparently the real expense is, you know, you use it and then you lose it. Mm. Some of the American private money is going into taking a rocket up and landing it back down on a platform on the sea and now on land itself. Then you can use it again and again and again. And that is going to, once you've perfected the science of it, is going to massively reduce the costs. So that's where India's gone. It's already been to Mars. Already sent an unmanned, obviously, spaceship to Mars. Did it first time it tried. And now it's seen that the future is in reusable. and it's going for reusable, and they see themselves as they are a great power. As I said, you can always make the argument about whether you should be using the money for incubators in hospitals.
But there is a skeptic's view of this. With all, you know, yes, they're a great power, and we, you know, and there's a lot to admire. I think what they really launched into space was a great PR campaign. I mean, let's be realistic. What Tim, 74 million, the U.S. space program, yes. 192 billion. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is not a space shuttle. It's a wannabe space shuttle.
Yeah, looked it up. It's 23 feet long. It's, you know, it's a sort of shrunk down one of the one they really would. It's a sixth of the size of the one
right.
that they were.
So it's modestly scaled.
It's like a child's rocket. It's, you know, it's like the things that we used to play with if you're old enough.
Is this kind of subprime space race then? Should we not get carried away?
Or it's a subprime. No, it's an above prime PR race about national pride and strutting and, you know, and more power to them on one level, I suppose, if you think that this is what matters. But I think it has to be looked at with a skeptical eye and a kind of, yeah, okay.
They say they may be ready with what they've learned from this test to build the real one in 15 years.
Okay, so let's all agree to meet back here in 15 years.
It's a day. Just on this point, actually, Tim, I think you made it about the fact that, you know, the space race has gone private. You know, you've got Elon Musks of this world. Is that... I don't know, it strikes me as a shame. I remember back in sort of the 80s, you know, NASA was this extraordinary institution. Yeah. The projects seemed so important for humankind. Now there's private capital there. Maybe that's just a reality. That's where the funding has to come from. Does that change the playing field of space exploration and space science?
You know, I think we've moved into a world where the cost benefit analysis is what drives these kind of things, and particularly for government, and particularly for the American government. I mean, I think that the ability to dream for the sake of dreaming is gone. I think it was a generational thing under Kennedy and
a Cold War race as well.
Right, that's true.
That's sad though, isn't it?
Well, it is if you're old like us. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm glad.
Yeah, but hang on. If my Levi's are better than your rusty cars and my space program is better than yours, ideologically I win the Cold War and eventually the wall right. comes down. That's a rather simplified version of the past 50 years.
It was never a great romantic thing anyway.
But I think that, you know, what's interesting historically about the space race in the U.S. is that it created this body of science that really, and innovation, that really inspired the world we live in today. I mean, I think that smarter minds than mine could draw a direct line from the space race to the iPhone to
things they put around you at the end of a marathon. I must very briefly tell you what I think is an apocryphal story, but the Americans spent, let's say, $77 million on trying to get a pen that would write upside down in space, and the Russians took a pencil.
Take from that what you will, listeners. Let's talk very briefly about Denmark before the show ends. If you're a British student, you're finishing university in the next few weeks, pack up your Che Guevara posters and book flights to Copenhagen. Denmark is top in an analysis of high starting salaries, average annual rent costs, and a relatively cheap living for UK graduates. Tim, does that ring true with you? Apparently, our best and brightest are being priced out of staying here in Blighty.
The people who are slightly younger than Geoffrey and I and have graduated have very different views of the world, and it is completely normal for them to look into other European, if they're British, for example, or wherever in Europe. They are more fluid. They go elsewhere and they go to where the life is good and is a fairly homogenized, globalized world. Denmark, as you said, the rents are low, the prices, the wages are high, whereas in London, for example, you know, you can barely get a cardboard box. So that's why people are gone. It's also, you know, it's a very civilized, very nice country. I was looking up what you do once you've been to Copenhagen. And in July, they have the world's biggest gathering of Santa Claus. You can visit the Carlsberg Brewery. I like Denmark, but
stop booking that ticket, Tim. Concentrate.
It's not somewhere I'd rather take my chances in Rio de Janeiro.
Geoffrey, time relatively short. I don't know, casting your own mind back, would you have, I don't know, where you did head immediately after your studies, Copenhagen work for you, do you think?
And the Canadian passport didn't get me very far, and I don't think actually the exchange visas that exist now for the youth mobility visas for Canadians, Australians, et cetera, and Brits existed in my day. Listen, these are the options for the privileged. Let's be clear. I mean, there's a big, you know, you talk about structural problems. Sitting in London, you know, the conversation is constantly about how can young people live and afford to live in London, and how can companies hire young people at the salaries that go, you know, pay for starting pay in London is so low. Teachers making well below 30,000 with several years of experience, and yet, you know, this is generation rent in London. Mm-hmm. People who will have to leave the region in order to ever own property.
They'll have to leave, and we have to leave.
Good segue.
Jeffrey Kaufman and Tim Marshall, thanks so much for being with us on Midori House. The show was produced by Rhys James, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Faith Barker, and Hannah Ritchie, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. More music next. Section D on the way at 1900. And this show's back at the same time tomorrow. I'll remind you once again, 1800 London time for your next instalment of Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Goodbye.